Welcome to KKRN Radio and Off the Shelf with Mary. I'm your host, Reverend Dr. Mary Mitchell, and I'll be sharing some of my favorite old and new nonfiction books about philosophy, spiritual psychology, science, metaphysics, business, and a special one today. And this might offer just the knowledge you've been looking for to enhance your life. You know, I've been thinking about recording a program on writing, and I finally got the courage. Personally, I've written 5 books, and after getting 15 KKRN radio shows under my belt, it feels like a good time to offer a program on my hobby, which is writing. We'll look at 2 books, Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg, published in 1986, and On Writing by Stephen King, published in 2000. You know, I bet most of you don't know Stephen King wrote something other than spine-tingling subjects. But let's go to the first book. So, who is Natalie Goldberg? She's an author that teaches the many aspects of writing around the country at schools and universities. And she has a special place in her heart for teaching, you know, junior high school students because they're so open in their mind. And I find her words very refreshing. And she always lifts me up to see ways of perceiving the world around me in a different way. It never occurred to Natalie to write, but in college she fell wildly in love with literature. Her interest started to shift when, in the early 70s, she decided to open a restaurant in Michigan, and she called it Naked Lunch. She did that after a phrase she read by William Burroughs, who wrote, "A frozen moment when everyone sees what is on the end of the fork." She became obsessed with making the most perfect and creative dishes, and one evening, after making a huge volume of eggplant for her customers, she stopped at a bookstore and picked up a volume of poetry entitled Fruits and Vegetables by Erica Jong. The first poem that caught her eye was about cooking eggplant. She was so surprised that one could write about something so ordinary. She was resolved to write when she knew her life, and she trusted her own thoughts and feelings. Around the same time, she began doing meditation with a local Zen center, where the Zen master encouraged her to make writing her spiritual practice and said it would take her everywhere. Natalie begins her classes by clarifying that writing is not a linear process. There is no logical ABC way to become a good writer. At times, it's about being specific, and then other times about losing control and riding the waves of emotion. Every moment is different, and one technique isn't wrong or right. But first things first, consider the pen we use. It should be a fast writing pen because our thoughts are always much faster than our hand. Next is the paper or notebook. It's our equipment, just like a hammer is to nails for a carpenter. So don't choose some heavy, awkward journal. Instead, get a cheap spiral notebook because it's easy to carry around. And choose one with a funny cover so you don't take yourself too seriously when you open it. It's okay to use a computer to write, but it's a more physical exercise. And the big black letters present a different aspect than how you see your writing when you're writing by hand. The best way to begin writing is to do a timed exercise, like 10 to 20 minutes on a subject. And here are the rules. Keep your hand moving. Listen for first thoughts. Don't cross anything out. There's no editing allowed. Don't worry about spelling, punctuation, or grammar. It's okay to lose control. Don't think, don't get logical, and then go for the jugular. You know, first thoughts have tremendous energy, and they're unencumbered by our ego, that part of us that wants to be in control. First thoughts may bring up emotions and energy that will kind of sweep us away, but don't stop writing. First thoughts have freshness and inspiration since they arrive in the present moment. And as her Zen teacher said, when you're present, the world is truly alive. Writing is a practice that, kind of like running, it gets better the more we do it. On days you may feel resistance, and some days you do your practice because in the middle of it you find you really do love it. But before you write, don't say, I'm going to write a poem, because that freezes you right away. Just sit down with the least expectation and know you are free to read, free to write the worst junk in the world. Write without a destination in mind. It's a place that you come to, like missing the taste and aroma and the smell of your grandmother's soup, while at the same time you're watching beautiful clouds outside the window. You might start writing with the word "this moment" and end up writing about a gardenia that you wore at your high school prom, and that's fine. Stay with whatever comes up and keeps your hand moving. If there are times that you sit down, pen in hand, and can't think of anything to write about, Valerie offers some great writing prompts, such as, write for 10 minutes about the quality of light coming through the window. Begin with, I remember, and all of a sudden a lot of memories will flood into your mind. Take something you feel strongly about and write about it as though you love it, and then turn the paper over and write about the same thing as though you hate it. That's a good exercise. Choose a color, and then take a 15-minute walk around your neighborhood, noting wherever that color shows up, and then go back and write about it. Sit in a restaurant or even a laundromat and pick up the rhythm of what's going on around you. Visualize a place you love and write about the details. Write about swimming, the stars, green places, strawberries, the closest you ever felt to God or nature, a special teacher you had. You know, the topics are endless. And she recommends try to fill a notebook a month, no matter what garbage you write. Valerie shares how important it is to use original detail in your writing. Life is so rich if you can write down the real details of the way things were and are, you hardly need anything else. If you describe the tall red stools from the Arrow Tavern where you drank in New York, or in a bar in another state at another time, the story will have authenticity and believability. For instance, if you've just been to New Orleans in the dripping August heat and you've sucked the fat out of the heads of crayfish at the Magnolia Bar on Charles Street, you can't then put your character in Cleveland on a freezing night in January doing the same thing. It just won't work. Natalie shares an example. I'm in Costa's Chocolate Shop in Owatonna, Minnesota with a friend. We just finished Greek salads and are writing in our notebooks for a half hour among glasses of water, a half-sipped Coke, and a cup of coffee with milk. The booths are orange, and at the front of the counter are lines of cream candies dipped in chocolate. Across the street is a bank designed by Louis Sullivan, Frank Lloyd Wright's teacher. Inside the bank is a large cow mural and beautiful stained glass windows. We're important, and our lives are important and worthy of being recorded. Here we are, human beings, pens in hand, and this is how we live. Our details are important. Otherwise, if they're not, we can drop a bomb and it doesn't matter. Natalie cautions that to her, writing is 99% listening. Listening so deeply to the space around us that it fills us, and then when we write, it just pours out of us. We may be listening to a person, but simultaneously to the air, the chair, the door, the sound of cars going by. Listening to the past, the future, and the present right where we are. Listening with our whole body, not just our ears, but with our hands, face, and the back of our neck. Before I run out of time, I want to share my favorite description Natalie wrote in her book, Long Quiet Highway. It's about her angel place, a place where you feel just so, so good. She had moved back to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and every morning she would take a walk. Here are her words why she loved it. Each morning before I began to write, I walked along the irrigation ditch in the South Valley of Albuquerque. The Sandia Mountains are in the distance to my left in a blue-purple haze. And close up all around me were snarling black dogs behind fences that also held old pickups, run-down adobe houses, chickens pecking at nails and pigweed, horses, goats, tires, and old bottles. How I loved those walks. The pale, soft yellow earth and the surprising rush of water with delicate green willows. I thought of that mile stretch along the ditch as one of my angel places. I felt good there, glad to be in New Mexico again, near Twitty's Rib Hut and Consuelo's Chili Rellenos. You know, KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and a team of volunteers who keep everything organized and running well. You're invited to support this amazing group by sending a donation to KKRN, P.O. Box 188, Round Mountain, California, 96805, or look for the donate button on the website. We also love donations of cars, trucks, boats, or motorcycles through careasy.org. But if you have any questions, just give us a call, 1-855-500-7433. The next book by Stephen King is entitled On Writing. So who is Stephen King? He's an American author that writes horror, suspense, crime, and science fiction. Not all my favorite books, but his one on writing I love. His books have sold more than 350 million copies. Many of his books have been adapted into film, television, miniseries, and comic books. This book about writing is about his life and how he got to where he is today. Stephen was born in 1947. In his first year of grade school, he had a horrible bout with his tonsils, and he missed so much of the first grade, he had to start over in the fall. But during the summer, while he was housebound, he read his way through about 6 tons of comic books, as he wrote. And he made stories and read books on war and animal tales. And at some point, he began to write his own stories and comics. Eventually, he showed his mother some of his work, and she was just charmed. She encouraged him to do better and offered to pay him 25 cents for each story he completed. So the first buck he made in the writing business was from selling his mom 4 stories about Mr. Rabbit Trick and his friends who rode around the country in a car. In the late 1950s, a science fiction collector, Forrest Ackerman, changed the lives of thousands of kids with a magazine called Famous Monsters of Filmland. Ackerman had also done a magazine called Spaceman, which covered science fiction films. In 1960, King sent his first story to Spaceman for publication. It was rejected, but interestingly, it wasn't returned to him. But a special note, 20 years later, while King was signing autographs in Los Angeles, Mr. Ackerman turned up in the line to get a signature, and he gave Stephen that single-spaced story that was typed on a Royal typewriter. King thought the whole encounter was surreal. But for King, a good story comes quite literally out of nowhere, sailing at you right out of the energy in the sky, or maybe 2 previously unrelated ideas all of a sudden come together and make something new. The writer's job isn't to find these ideas, but to recognize them when they show up. One day, he got a really good idea where his mother remarked that she needed 6 more books of green stamps to get a lamp she wanted for Christmas. Are you old enough to remember saving green stamps? Well, I am, and so I'm kind of dating myself, but I remember doing it myself. Anyway, as she was licking the stamps and putting them in the little booklets, she stuck out her tongue at Stephen, and it was S&H Green. He immediately thought of a storyline where they would find a way to make these stamps in the basement and call it Happy Stamps. The hero of the story was a poor schmuck, Roger, who had been in jail 2 times for counterfeiting money. This time he began to counterfeit Happy Stamps. King visualized one scene where Roger and his mother, were sitting in the living room in awe over the Happy Stamps catalog. And while the printing press ran downstairs, it was pounding out bale after bale of stamps. Roger said, with 6 million books, they could probably get a house in the suburbs. But Roger discovered that, although the stamps were perfect, the glue was defective. As Roger licked the stamps, his tongue turned pink. So King sent the story to various magazines, including Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, but he only received rejection slips. He pounded a nail on the wall in his writing area where he hung every rejection slip. And by the time he was 14, he had so many rejection letters, he had to replace the nail with a spike, but he kept on writing. That's the key. In high school, King got himself into an assortment of trouble by plagiarizing manuscripts, and then he wrote a high school newsletter called The Village Vomit. I bet that excited the kids, but it sure did not excite the school principal or the guidance counselor. They were desperate to shift his focus, and they finally got him hired as a sports reporter for the city's weekly newspaper. He was paid 1/2 cent a word, and in no time his articles were lengthened to feature pieces, and eventually the boss said, if you keep this up, you're never going to have to work for a living. Well, kind of as if work was not, if writing was not work. Well, years later, after marriage and raising children, King had published 3 novels and was working on one of his most famous, Carrie. When he thought he was done with it, he put it away for a few months, and then he got it out to reread it, and he saw 4 problems. First, the story didn't move him emotionally. Second, he didn't like the lead character, and he didn't trust her. Third, he didn't like all the girls in the cast of supporting characters. And fourth, it needed to be a lot longer to sell. He concluded that his original perception of the characters would be confusing to readers. So he realized this, and that stopped the story because it was hard emotionally and imaginatively. It was a bad idea. He found it hard to restart. But then a friend of him encouraged to think back about his high school years and imagine what life was like for the girls in his school. Those who were lonely, those who were badgered, those who were popular, how they were treated, what their homes must have been like, and the hobbies of their parents. Well, this stimulated just the ideas he needed to complete Carrie. And now you know the rest of that story. In 1973, he sent the manuscript off to Doubleday Publishing and forgot about it. Weeks later, he received a telegram that Carrie would be a Doubleday book if he would accept $2,500 in advance. Wow. They bought a car and rented a new apartment, and his enthusiasm for writing skyrocketed. It wasn't long before Doubleday called him to let him know that Signet Books wanted to purchase the rights to Carrie. Forget this. $400,000. Wouldn't I love to get a call like that? In his book, King offers some suggestions, such as the importance of finding a favorite place to write, a place where the inspiration just kind of flows by, like what he calls a far-seeing place. It's a place that's quiet enough to catch those intuitive ideas. Yet ideas can come to us just about anywhere. We might be sitting in traffic, waiting in a doctor's office, or in a laundromat on a rainy day. But sitting in your far-seeing place, they come unbidden. His place is in the basement where the light is good, and he has his favorite blue chair, and there's just a good vibe in the room. King challenges us that when we get a vibrational hint to act, move it along, move it forward into a story or a draft of a story. He offers this prompt. So if you've got a pen and a paper, write this one down. See what you can do with this. There is a table covered with a red cloth. On it is a cage, and in it is a rabbit with a pink nose and pink-rimmed eyes. In its front paws is a carrot stub, and it's contentedly munching it. On its back, clearly marked in blue ink, is the number 8. Now, we can approach creating this story with this basic information, and we may feel nervous or excited or hopeful or even despair. What do you do with that? We can come at it with fists clenched and eyes narrowed, ready to be aggressive about that number 8. And take names, but he cautions, do not come lightly to the blank page. Take this writing seriously. It's not a contest. It's not the moral Olympics. And it's not church. It's writing, not washing the car. If we're ready to take it seriously, let's go. Otherwise, it's time to close the book and do something else. King's grandfather was a carpenter that taught him an important lesson. He had a 3-layer toolbox, and he hauled it everywhere with him so that he was never without a tool. He didn't have to go back home to get it or back to the car to get it. Everything was in his toolbox. And King applied this to writing. To write our best, construct our own toolbox, and then build up enough muscle to carry it with us. And in that way, we'll always have the correct tool wherever we are, so we can get to work immediately when that vibe hits. Grandpa's toolbox had 3 levels, but he believes the writer should have 4. Common tools like vocabulary go on top because the best writers have enormous vocabularies. But he cautions that what we don't want to do is dress up the vocabulary, like looking for longer words because we may be a little ashamed of our short ones. He writes that it's like dressing up a household pet in evening clothes. The pet is embarrassed, and the person who committed this act of premeditated cuteness should even be more embarrassed. Instead, use the first word that comes to mind, if it's appropriate and colorful. Grammar also goes on top of the book, on top of the toolbox. Assuming we're an adult, and we have either absorbed the grammatical principles of our native language in conversation and in reading, or not. Assuming we have, then once we start writing, it's a matter of cleaning the rust off the drill bits and sharpening the saw blade. If we need a brush up on grammar, he recommends Warner's English Grammar and Composition. Now, Warner's is spelled W-A-R-R-I-N-E-R apostrophe S. Believe me, I just ordered it this morning. If we want to be a writer, we must do 2 things above all else. Read a lot and write a lot. There's no way around it. No shortcuts. We read good writing to learn about style, graceful narration, plot development, the creation of believable characters, and truth-telling. We also read the mediocre and the outright rotten in order to recognize those things when they begin to creep into our own work and to steer clear of them. We also read in order to measure ourselves against the good and the great and in order to experience different styles. Reading is the creative center of a writer's life. When writing a good story in mind, begin writing 1,000 words a day to avoid discouragement. King's goal is to get 10 pages a day completed, which is about 2,000 words. But over a 3-month period, it adds up to about 180,000 words, which is a good length for a book. Begin writing about what we know. If we're a plumber, we know plumbing. But our heart also knows things, and so does our imagination. And we may begin writing about what we love to read. King's writing began with his love of horror comic books and broadened out from there. Significant time in his book is spent sharing his expertise in good storytelling. All stories return to the same core ideas: developing skills in description, dialogue, and character development. That boils down to seeing or hearing clearly and expressing it with equal clarity. When we've completed the draft of a book, imagine, could you do that in 3 months? Like he said, be great. It's important to take a couple days off and to do something completely different. Let the book rest a minimum of 6 weeks in a desk drawer. Resist the temptation to reread some passages. Instead, move forward with a new project. And only when we're so involved in the new project that we've almost forgotten what's in the drawer, then take it out. Shut the door, pencil in hand, yellow tablet by your side. Read the manuscript in one sitting, if possible. In this way, we're able to see any glaring holes in the plot or character development and motivation. Delete all adverbs. Ask if this story is coherent. Do the recurring elements intertwine and make a theme? What's it all about? How can we make underlying concerns even clearer? Does it resonate with the reader? Can scenes and incidents be added that reinforce our goal? Where should stuff be deleted that goes in a different direction? And what will the target reader think when they read this part? King's target reader is his wife. She lets him know if the pace or the speed with the writing, how the writing unfolds, is good or too fast. Does it go so fast it leaves the reader behind? Where does she get bored with a certain scene? Where does she find it easy to just put it down and go do something else? And are there any darlings that should be deleted? Oh yes, those darlings. They're your favorite words or personalities, but our target reader may find them unnecessary. When the target reader says that, get rid of the darlings. You know, we have to be cautious because book buyers aren't usually attracted by the literary merits of a novel. Book buyers want a good story to take with them on an airplane, something that will fascinate them, put them in and keep them in to turning the pages. King thinks this happens when readers recognize people in a book or their own behaviors or surroundings or their own vocabulary. When the reader hears strong echoes of their own life, they are more apt to become interested in the story. In an interview for New Yorker magazine, King told the interviewer that he believes stories are found things like fossils that you find in the ground. But the interviewer didn't believe him. But King said, "I believe it." And he explained that stories aren't like souvenir t-shirts. They're relics, part of an undiscovered pre-existing world. And the writer's job is to use the tools in their toolbox to get as much of each one out of the ground intact as possible. You know, sometimes the uncovered fossils are small, like maybe a seashell, and sometimes they're enormous, like a Tyrannosaurus rex. Either way, whether it's a short story or a 1,000-page whopper of a novel, the techniques of excavation remain basically the same. We discover the plot using a jackhammer, and then finer parts are discovered with a shovel, and a lot of the organic details arise naturally, and sometimes we uncover them with a toothbrush. Another way to look at it is the situation comes first, then the characters, then the narration, and then the characters do what they do, and sooner or later, every story ends somewhere. Now, on page 170, King offers us the location of a fossil and then challenges the reader to write 5 or 6 pages of unplotted narration about it as we dig the bones and see what they look like. I don't have time to share the fossil with you, but it's a familiar story that seems to pop up in police sections of the Metropolitan Daily News every other week or so. So he asks us to do the exercise again by changing the sexes of the characters and then see how it changes everything. Or does it? If you're encouraged to write, I hope you get the book and do the exercise because guess what? Then you'll get to know the rest of the story. Oh, and I'm dating myself again. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about the wild mind of Natalie Goldberg and Stephen King's keys to the writing trade. And the music I'll share right now is from an acoustical guitar CD by the Lemming Shepherds called Symphony for the Senses. And it even comes with a full-color brochure about their many adventures. Until next week, may peace be with you.